We have this very important deal. At the end, we just try to discuss the time frame. And we are also going to be saying something about the People's Assembly. I'll hand over to the captain.
Thank you very much, Secretary. Honorable members, first I'd like to apologize on behalf of my colleagues and Dante Peter, who is currently out of the country. No, I need the technical things of the strike. Ginger has been here leading the team, and he asked me to come and accompany our leader team so that we can make it to him. Our team that will be doing the presentation is led by Pierre Walker, our leader of the gentleman who I accepted. And he produced private now, advocate channels now, both advocates, and also they are the two who are taking the food to the
A colleague of mine who held up in another
The main amendment will be in the education and National Education Policy Act of 1996 and also the South African Schools Act of 1996. And then there is some smallest amendments and some technical amendments than in the National Student Financial Act of 1999 and the South African Council of Education Act of 2000 and the Adult Basic Education and Training Act of 2000, as well as the General Study Education and Training Quality Assurance Act of 2001. Those matters, which is of legislation and small protections, and they have a lot of amendments that changes that came as a result of the 30 Education and Training Act, which is in effect over last year, and also the extension of the financial schemes, not only higher education, but also to financial schemes. So here it is not going into the substance, but also to open up the amendment. That adds to the first. Two pieces of legislation, the National Policy Act and the South African Schools Act. The more substantial amendments will be focusing on those two pieces of legislation. The schools 1 and 3, I think, could be read together because they link up with one another. And with your permission, I would like to deal with those two as a combination. There's also some of the other clauses which I will also use for a combination because of the nature of the clause. The clause 1 is an amendment to Section 5 of the National Education Policy Act, and clause 3 is an amendment to Section 11 of the same Act. This is a piece of legislation Union Acted in 1996, by that respect, the interim constitution has been in effect, and where education legislation has to be negotiated. You remember the old 247 section in the interim constitution? There was a lot of focus on constituencies and also the mandate coming from constituencies, which was not focused on the educational aspect, but more the mandate coming from such constituencies. And also, it was embedded in that process the notion of negotiation rather than consultation. In terms of the development of education, the all the structures in education became advisory rather than negotiation structures because of the difficulty and also the problem of negotiating legislation with a structure where it is actually the domain of Parliament to deal with legislation, and the Parliament cannot negotiate a disagreement on legislation. Of course, they don't have the authority to do it. It's Parliament who must deal with that. Furthermore, it is also important that when you look at all the structures giving advice, there's quite a proliferation of these structures where we saw, for instance, last year with the National Board on Study Education and Training, which is also a structure which arrives from these provisions, that Parliament actually decided to take it out of play because it became a structure which has no effect and which is not effective in any way, and therefore it was not necessary to continue with it as a structure. It was only referred to in the transitional arrangement in the process of winding up that process. And the reason for it is that when you deal with legislation, when you deal with policy, there is other legislation which takes the responsibility to the decision maker. And where there is a need to consult in terms of that, Parliament by their own rules. We saw the constitutional judgment, where Parliaments are forced to comply with their own rules. I'm talking about those health changes, the health legislation which was taken to Parliament. Parliament also are the ones who will deal with it in terms of their internal processes, will deal with public hearings, will deal with consultation and will have engagement on legislation, and therefore it is not necessary to have their detailed prescription which is not always in line with those processes. So here, that's one of the aspects. The other aspect has also been that education, the minister, when dealing with policy, he also follows process. He is out in terms of promotion of administrative justice act to adhere to specific process. He must have public hearing or consultation before any decision can be taken in terms of that act. That's an act deriving out of the constitution. But here all these pieces of legislation are becoming quite a network of provisions which can be quite confusing in the end and which cause a difficulty if it is not streamlined. With this approach, we try not to take away the importance of having consultation, but to deal with it in a more, or to follow more the approaches given to us in terms of FAGA, the Prevention of Administrative Act, and also principles in the Constitution and internal processes and, in fact, this piece of legislation in order to deal with it in a constructive way. It is also important
that the body created in terms of nipot can only give advice. They do not have any other function than to advise the minister. And it is also important to note that even within the structures, it is bodies that will become constituted from organizations which will make nominations, but it's appointed by the minister, and where the expertise of the member is the focus. So it's expert bodies instead of constituency bodies. The only constituency body that you would find nowadays is that of the Education Labour Relations Council, because of the dynamics in negotiating conditions of service. So for all the others, when it comes to policy making, when it comes to taking decisions in relation to educational issues, the minister can only get advice from the structures created by the minister. And this amendment is in line with those principles. So here the intention is, first of all, with those provisions, to provide a alignment with the legislation, the current legislation applicable, provide easy language in this legislation to deal with the implementation of it, and to deal with it in a manner which the minister can still get advice, but deal with it in a situation where she can obtain the advice before she takes the decision, and therefore adhere to the very important principle that consultation must be obtained before there is such a decision. Here, it is also important, if you look at that the minister, in terms of the current legislation, shall determine through regulation a National Education and Training Council, and in the new legislation it is put as the minister may provide for such a structure. And here it is once again, it is also piggybacking on the situation we've had with the National Board on Service Education and Training, where the structure were not effective enough to really justify the existence, and to have a compulsory provision in the legislation is therefore creating a difficulty. If there's a need, then the measures must be there, and that's why it's so proposed to be on the statute book. But if there's no need, then obviously it's just a copyright, and it shouldn't be a compulsory provision. But here, that's the reason where there is a rewording of these two sections. In essence, it is the same principle that's coming through. It is not a deviation from the need to consult. It is so that it must be the role players, that is, in terms of FASA, it is compulsory, and it is a given part of our statutory laws. And here, lastly, the practice created in terms of clause 11, our section 11 is still there. The only thing the NEDC, or the National Council on Education and the National Education and Training Council, is not compulsory, but it's still a structure which the minister can put in place in order to provide them with the necessary advice. Here, clause 2 is just a technical amendment. The Education Labour Relations Act of 1993 has been repealed by the Labour Relations Act, and this is just oversight. It should have been corrected a long time ago, but it was not repeated up, and it's just a technical amendment. Here, clause 4 is rest with clause 7. 6 is also linked to each other, and I think if we can deal with clause 4 the 6 and 7 as a combination again. Here, there is new concept that's been introduced in the legislation, and where there was a need to provide definition to it. The first definition is that of a dangerous object. It is wider than just a weapon, a firearm, which is the situation in the Firearms Act. But there is a need to go wider than firearms, because in public schools we've seen horrific incidences of violence in schools where other objects like scissors and things like that have been used, and which took lives or endanger the life of learners. And this is in line with safety regulations which have already been promulgated by the minister a few years ago, and even amended last year. So here, this is a definition which provides a wider definition to what is a dangerous object, and links it to anything that can harm, unless it is for an educational situation or a legal thing. You would find it in clause 6 that is referenced, unless it is for a legal or legitimate, is the word, a legitimate educational purpose, then it would be allowed. Otherwise, it would be an object which cannot be found in a school setup. Here, the next definition is that of illegal drugs, and that is a definition which is once again linked to substances that you would find in a school environment, and which is obviously, it shouldn't be there, and it is a definition of a drug, which is obviously, there is quite a number of definitions in the dictionary, and there was a need to give a more direct definition to it in order to bring more clarity to the whole concept in clause 6. Here, and then the last thing is school activity. This is also an issue, because the school activity is wider than the school premises. You get sport events, you get cultural events, you will find that the school will go beyond the premises and still deal with the school activities, and you also need to control and ensure the safety of the learners during those outings. So here, the need to identify the school activity to be within or outside the school premises has been the reason for that definition. Here, that is then linked to clause 7, and I want to deal with that one first, because that is the one which is dealing with random search and seizure and drug testing. We have already alluded to the fact that there is safety regulations and where they are.
Can I suggest we pause at this? Before we go to that issue, we depend on sample that said. The main subset of the amendment. I can't remember, you can't make the argument quite much. So that if you go to the old, you lost in the process. My understanding, therefore, is that in our section 1, it's not that much new, not that we see how that is going to be done. The consultation is still there. If you go to 3, the most important part there is that subsection 1. The minister may, if I release it, this is changing from SARS to May. And I'm wondering if I hear here and where it says, this latest experience And the proposal here is that this board, this national education and training council, it should not be a star, it should be a maid, so that if whatever is, as time goes on, and this is something that is applying for even in all other bodies, all the other bodies that I have, I want us to call them as a committee, so that if there's any questions on that of clarity, we entertain those. So that we move on.
Thank you, Paul. I just have a question here. Have you been advised by the said body on any matter? Will the minister not intend to overlook the need for consultation with the affected party? For instance, if I'm to give an example, as it is happening now in Kaso, where the people on the ground are neglected, but the decisions are imposed on them because of a particular advice that might have been obtained somewhere. Thank you.
I'm not sure I'm trying to contextualize what you are saying, because if I is recommended by the consultant, there is nothing new, but it is not moving away from contamination, if you look at the first part. So the only thing that is new here is that this new body, National Education and Training Council, it's not that we're doing away with. It's not that it's not going to be consulted. The only new thing there is that instead of putting it in a casting stone, it shall be, when I say it may. So unless when you talk with them, you could talk about the specific advice coming from a specific sector, which was ignored otherwise.
I understand what you're saying, where you're coming from.
Yes.
If I hear you correctly, same question I'm going to ask. What will then, if May, which is important, what will then compel the minister to consult? It will depend on how good will she be dead. A minister who is by nature not prone to consultation. She'll just steam ahead with whatever she wants because it's me. I don't know that I'm understanding what you said.
No, the Baba is saying the main part does not affect the that one. If there's any border to be done away, it can only be done away in two levels. If the minister wants to go away with this, and DSC, as long as she's there, by law, she has to consult.
I think it is important also to remember that the relations of art is not a particular action derives directly from the Constitution, and it provides that even in the Tucson case, the institution taken by a minister, we should take any of the citizens negative. It must be a process of at least giving an opportunity to be heard. It doesn't mean that you must follow it, but at least give an opportunity. It can be in writing, it can be by public hearing, it can be in terms of a notice and comment process. Here, that is only if there's a decision taken by the administrator. That is what this is also about. When you make policy, when you deal with the policy issues, and where it is affecting the lives of the citizens. So, we still got the fire in place, we still got this as a specific provision to the education, and it is not taking away that right of or that mechanism for the minister to consult. It is just providing a specific structure within which the consultation can take place. And this is also very flexible, because the family, though, is there to meet even beyond that we need to see and allow for additional practice in order to address specific needs. So here, the regulation provides a mechanism, and the mere fact that it says a may provision doesn't mean that the minister can just ignore it. This is a decision which the minister will take, that there is obviously...
The late comer has not come close to the chest.
That's clear, there is obviously structure in the role, and there can be pressure on the minister to act in the piece of legislation. And there's a lot of mechanisms in legislation which force the minister to deal with it in a constructive way, because that is the framework within which the minister must be provided in all my responsibilities.
I thought that question of Honorable Panchani was also covered by one, you know, which says the policy contemplated in Section 3 shall be determined by the Minister after consultation with such appropriate consultative bodies as have been established. So, in addition to all those other structures that Stephen has outlined, I think one also commits the Minister to consult with these bodies. Thank you, Chair.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chair. I think that the whole idea of this body, this council, was to give specific identified stakeholders the opportunity to make an input as far as policy making. Are there any other structures in place that also provide stakeholders with the opportunity to make an input as far as policy making or are the other structures with regard to labor related matter and the case maybe, but not specifically concerning the policy related matter. Secondly, it seems that as I understand this legislation, as long as maybe given can clarify that, as long as this specific council exists, and that is now within the discretion of a minister to decide if the council exists or not, as long as it exists, there must be consultation with it. But then again, this minister may at a later stage, or next minister may decide to do away with the specific council at any time when, in the opinion of the minister, there is no need for such a thing. And then, of course, the obligation to consult will also fall away. Consult with this body concerning policy matters, because then there won't be a body of this nature anymore. Is that correct? And then in the third instance, it seems to me that the other major difference here is that previously this body, this council, had to be constituted in a specific way with specific stakeholders that are identified in the legislation. But now in future it would also be in the discretion of the minister to decide who she wants to involve, he or she wants to involve in this specific structure. Is that a correct indication? Thank you, Chair.
Just to first of all, the NEPA Act, as it is currently worded, it provides that the NETC and the membership shall just reflect the national stakeholders in the education system, and the composition, the qualifications of membership, the duties, the powers, and the functions will be prescribed by the minister in terms of the regulation. So the current legislation is only providing the framework that does not contain main stakeholders, national stakeholders, and also as to the composition and the way it is put together, it is already in the domain of the minister. And stand by the regulations issued in the authority of the minister. That's section 11, 1 and 2 that we're talking about. It is true that if it is a my position, then it is a but here it is also true that there's many provisions, as I've already indicated in legislation, where it is my provision that the dynamics of a situation would require any reasonable person to exercise that mechanism. And even if you take the word scenario, there is still protection for the constituencies to be consulted in their own name in terms of parliament. Here it is important that when there is such a structure of NEPC, it is not a constituency body anymore. It is a body which will then give advice as the NEPC. And here that is where we found in education that constituency bodies became very difficult to manage. The NEPC has been one of those where the members must act on mandate instead of dealing with educational expertise that requires to deal with the functions of such bodies. And you would find that in the consultation process, you will get the same thing position coming from a structure and the individual members, because it is not the mandate cannot be carried throughout the structure, and it also puts pressure on that structure to deliver. So here the intention is for the minister to get advice from statutory structures on educational issues. When it comes to constituencies, the minister of force them apart to get that advice from that constituency himself, and will still get that advice through consultation process. We are getting it through notices, and I can quote quite a number of, in fact, we've got a whole track record through many years where that actually happened. And where you would find in the publication of a policy or even a bill to take to Parliament, where it is not even required by law to actually, or in any other piece of legislation, that you must publish it for comment, that the minister would in any event do it in order to get that input as well, because constituencies are important, but it is when you deal with structures, you want to get the advice on an educational basis and not a constitutional, but a constituency basis. So here, that is the reason for this amendment, and it is true, as Gowan is 100% correct, that it is a discretion, and in theory it is possible to amend the regulation, the minister can do. But here it is also, as I said, it is a situation where the minister can also, like in the case of the NDFET, could have changed that position, because that was a discretional one, and despite that, it was brought to Parliament last year, and the Parliament also endorsed that there is a structure made of a specific need and role, and it is not just it shouldn't be just there because it is convenient or popular to have it. It might have a direct function.
There's one aspect of my question that was not answered. I'd just like to know, of course, one aspect that from time to time when the minister decides to do so, to consult people on policy, whatever it might be. But is it correct that there's no other structure in terms of legislation that expects from the minister to consult such a structure, on policy making? Is that correct?
I think the other fact is the part of the legislation, which is paper and policy, which is dealing with policy which could have negative implications. And many policies do have that aspect, too, which of course is involved in the decision making structure, that there is a need to publish it and to get proper consultation on this. And as the FIDA also provides the either a meeting, public hearing, or a notice comment approach in order to deal with that consultation, that could be required. So in education, this is the one applicable to school, but you would also find that as I said, for higher education, we do have this CHE, which is also a statute which gives us rights in terms of the Higher Education Act.
Yeah, but essentially, but PAJA, would you agree with me, PAJA will only relate to limited aspects of policy making, not the whole aspects. It will only be, as you indicated now, with regard to policy that negatively affects whoever the case may be. So it wouldn't, that wouldn't cover all policy related matters and wouldn't require consultation with regard to all policy.
That's very difficult to separate policy where there's a mix of matters in it, and there will always be something with the potential that might affect a specific individual negatively, because it deals with the public at large. So our experience has been that all policies will be subjected to that process, not only in our department, in all the other departments as well, because of the nature of policy, which was a combination of factors. And even if there's just one aspect which has might have a negative implication, compliant with the provisions of FIDA.
Thank you, I want to
thank you. In the code of section 3 is concerned, I would like to move the explanation, because here we are looking at the NECC to be a body of experts, which is differentiated from the constituents. Sometimes look at the constituents that we are talking about. The fact that in section 5, we are saying there's no need for consultation, and now in section 3, we are saying the minister may consult with this body. It may give an impression that you would like to exclude some constituents. So I would like to recommend that section 3, that the minister may by regulation establish the body of experts, known as the NECC, and other expert bodies, just to qualify it. That's a recommendation.
Yes.
Yeah,
I just want to not a body of
in terms of section 11, which is in terms of regulation, and the regulation requires that specific, whether any person with an educational background and the specific requirements that have been put as the criteria for the minister to make the appointment, and that if there's a nomination from the broad national stakeholders that will do it, that there, the constituency as you would find here currently is not in place. It is principles based on expertise, and the only thing we provide is not to get rid of the UCC because it is still there. It is just the need to put it as a compulsory in place of the discretion. So that's the only amendment that we provide. It is not to be saying the nature of the body. That is not the intention.
I'm trying to put members that we confine ourselves to the amendment. If we start to open it, we are not going to finish. I want us to clarify ourselves as far as this amendment is concerned. And I'm trying to highlight, as far as Section 3, the main amendment there is that everything is in place. The only amendment there is that instead of saying start, by saying me. And the example that has been used as the motivation of that was the Dutch national equality. And we're saying, and even other bodies that are there, it's not as far as it may. I don't want us to widen. Once we start widening, we're not going to finish. And that's my to make that proposal. That's the only thing.
Yeah, no,
If there are no other issues, therefore, on that section 1, section 3, and those divisions. Okay, can you move on? Yes.
So on section 4. I wanted to address a technical issue. It says here, any article, object, or instrument that may be employed to cause bodily harm to a person or damage to property, or to render a person temporarily paralyzed or unconscious. My question is, what about permanently paralyzed and unconscious? Why don't you just say paralyzed or unconscious? You need temporarily or permanently or whatever it takes you.
But if you look at the totality, if there's any other object or instrument that may be employed to cause body harm, that harm could be a complete absence and to a person or damage the property, or to render a person. I don't think it prevents that definition. The first part is any actual object or instrument that may be employed to cause body harm. That body harm has no limit.
Yeah.
And again, in order to stress this, even if it happens to be temporary, it is covered. In the first part.
I was just leave out that temporarily. But I leave it in the hands of the legal. not in your
Can you move therefore to 7? I think we're on 7 now.
I will come back to 5 because it's also a very important one. It's just because if they can meet the meeting after 7. 7 is a very interesting one. And as I said, it must be related with the regulations that are already in place. But when it comes to certain things, it's got constitutional implications. If there's an aspect where a person who is subjected to that system got constitutional rights to dignity, not be subjected to abuse, and also should not be victimized through a position which can easily link to that type of situation or practices. And the whole notion of random is also very important. If you look at the dictionary definition of it, it means that you have people who sit here and I would say that one, that one, that one. There's no reason behind it, there's no method behind it, it is just a subjective decision-making process. And in law it is always very difficult to deal with that. And that is why in this section, random got a specific definition which comes out of the context of the tool. It is not random in the sequence of the word. It is random, which is linked, and subtlety is very important in that regard. It is linked to any group of learners or property of a group of learners for a dangerous or legal substance, and then within specific criteria, which is also tied to the content on a reasonable suspicion. I say it is important that randomness is still part of it because there is a group of people, and normally when you deal with reasonable suspicion, it is not only suspicion of the activity but also related to the person who actually conducts that activity. In this case, the reasonableness must be on the activity, there must be a reasonable suspicion of the activity, but the randomness is related to a wider group than the actual individual, because you don't know which individual. You found a box of Zappa in a bus. You know there was a group consisting of specific learners in that bus. But you don't know which one might carry the other Dhaka with it. So therefore, you can identify that group of learners, that load of learners, and you can do a search on them. So the randomness is still related to the group, but the activity will not be a reasonable suspicion, so that you don't open it up to you. And then a reasonable suspicion means what it is. What is the actual definition of it? We found in a lot of court cases that it is the basis of reasonableness, which is linked to what an average ordinary person would consider reasonable. And it is also a suspicion doesn't mean it is absolute true. But it is, means that it must be enough to raise a question mark on what is going on there. If you find a box full of Zappa, there's something that needs it there. There is some substance to it, and now it's a matter of identifying the link between the activity and the person. And this solution is to provide for that in a school setup. Here it is also very important in order to comply with constitutional principles that it must be very directed. It must be for internal purposes. It cannot open up a whole weekend where you use this way of gathering information to actually get a process going in another forum.
Yes.
There's other people who might exercise different rights in terms of different rules. But the focus of the school will be to deal with it in terms of an internal process and handle the whole exercising of these powers within the framework of the act and aim at either dealing with it through a disciplinary process or counseling, which will be contained or must be contained in the code of conduct of the school. The chair is very focused. It's got a specific purpose, and it is linked to the reasonable suspicion of the activity in order to come to a identification of an individual or individual who is actually participating in it. So that is the principle behind this whole session, our course. Here, this course contains also two aspects: the carrying of a dangerous object, as well as illegal drugs and the drug testing relating to that. When it comes to dealing with dangerous objects, it also provides a specific criteria which must be taken into account, and that is what you would find in subsection 3 or subclause 3, and which involves the best interest of the other learners, with also the health and safety of the other learners, and once again the reasonable evidence of the illegal activity which I've already alluded to, and any evidence, all other relevant evidence to that effect. So Chair, it is really important that school must be a safe environment, but it must also be governed to the fact that you don't want to abuse the measure by victimizing people also during that process. And here, the whole purpose of this was to try and balance it out. And here, as I've already indicated, this dangerous object might also include educational or instruments that is used in an educational process. So, part of an educational process, you might even find knives in catering. Part of it, you might have knives to cut meat, all those things. So here, what is important in sub one is, unless there is a legitimate educational purpose, a child can bring a knife to the school. And that is what we want to achieve through this. It is not to hamper the educational process, but to ensure their safety in the school. The next thing which is also very important is when you deal with the certain teacher, it must be proportional to it. If you can use the certain teacher by just searching the locker and not going to the person's body, then it is by law, and this is the position we put you to the committee, is that you rather go to the property and you rather search that. And it's only with, as the last option, you would move to the body. And here, when you deal with these objects, you also, by definition, a dangerous object also involves firearms, which is in law, it is required to have a license. Now you require a principal or his delegatee to take that firearm away from the learner. And this proposal also provides then the process of documenting the actual dangerous weapon properly, have a proper record of it, and ensure that it is given over to the police services, who will then take the responsibility of taking care of that, both the illegal substance or drug as well as the firearm. And here, if the police services is not able to come and collect it from the school, then which is the principal order delegatee, who must go and deliver it to the police office and also make sure there is a track record of that. So, by law, that person will have to be protected to have it in his or her possession during that period of time without having any legal consequences to it. And then, lastly, when it comes to the illegal drugs, if you find from clause 700, it is very important that it is done by way of a test, which is a urine test, and it is in terms of the device, which will be determined by the minister in terms of regulation, and we will also provide the necessary, the regulations will also provide the necessary guidance on the usage of such a device. And then clear what is also important both for the search and seizures as well as the urine testing. It must be done in privacy, where it is not in the view of the learner and chair, especially sub 9 B and C is very important. In B you would find it is done in a private area and not in the view of another learner. So if there is more than one learner in that private area, then it must be outside the view of that other learner. And they must turn it back to the activity. And in C, there must be a witness. Because we are dealing with a very sensitive activity. There must be a witness to see that the one who's conducting this action of doing it in a proper manner. And also if there's a trouble, to give evidence on how it was done. But once again, that witness must be outside the view of the learner who is the subject of that activity. So it is giving the privacy aspect is very important, and we try to deal with it in terms of the solution. So here it is very important also that in the very last clause, and that is clause 14, it is that the intention is for the school to deal with it as an internal process, and it is not for the school to then bring charges outside the school. But obviously, a parent or the other learner who might be the subject of the illegal assault with that dangerous object can still press charges and can still deal with it in terms of his or her own rights. But for the purpose of this issue, it is aimed at an internal process to ensure that there is a mechanism to make schools a safer place. There's a last aspect, and that is clause 6 has also been as a result of this, and that is an amendment to section 8 of the Schools Act, which is dealing with the code of conduct, and which provides an obligation on the schools to ensure that the code of conduct must also not only deal with a disciplinary process, that also deals with a counseling process and also the process of safeguarding the interests of the other learners and align it with the intention as is reflected in clause 7.
Can you repeat 9A, the process of measures by testing at the same time. I would imagine that is a key factor.
Yes.
And then C is a witness who happens to be a key counselor of the same demonstration. In fact, but last part, but not in the view of them. Is the first speaker in view of them?
Yes. The one who's conducting it must be the search, and that one will obviously be as a witness. Must not be the witness. So the witness will witness from the backside of the person that's been searched. So it is provide the privacy to that person because it is not in the view of that learner who's been searched, that it is so possible for that witness to give evidence on what actually happened during that privacy.
One speaker is doing, another witness is not doing, or he is a witness. If one can do, why is the witness not doing? So that you can testify.
Yeah, of course, to go on with that argument, I can't see where there can be privacy.
I think to me, if the first keeper is there seeing, and the one is a witness, but the witness must not see. He must not as well not be there. Because if he's going to be there to testify, he must say, as this third speaker was there, I was also there. Therefore, it happened this way. If he is going to be outside, I can't see the logic, but that's fine.
Yeah, maybe that's not what it's not that you're outside. In the same area, you must see what's going on, otherwise you're not a witness. And you don't need to. If I'm watching what's going on with the person in front of me, I can view it either from the front of that person, or from the back, or from the side. Now this one is just saying that when you view it, you must be outside the view of the learner. And it is the protection of the learner's right not to be exposed during that process. It is an invasive procedure. There's no doubt about it. But what it is trying to do with this provision is to make it as the least infringement of a right by the one who's subjected to it. And by viewing it from behind the learner, you can still give a proper evidence of what is actually happening there. You don't need to view it from the front, at the front of the learner. Yeah, that was the intention behind it. Obviously, the committee can engage on it. The reason why there is it in both B and C is to try and protect the right of learners, even under those circumstances, especially because we are talking about a random search. It's a lot of learners that might be subjected to such innocence. And one must be mindful that one tries to protect them as far as possible and to give them the least embarrassment out of that experience.
You know, I understand what you're saying. No, I want to explain something. I wanted to demonstrate something. You see, this will be in court, and in court there are what you call technicalities. And a person may just come out on technicalities. Now, the person who conducts the search is in front of the learner. Now the witness stands at the back. The learner might be having drugs here in front, under the shed, between the shed and the trouser, or the gun. Now the person who searches might draw a gun from in front of this person, but the witness doesn't see it. Now what is going to happen in court is, the witness is going to be asked, did you see it in his person? And he said, no, I didn't see it because I was at the back. He was being searched by this man. It weakened the evidence that he didn't see it. The person who conducted the search might have come with it and put it in. That's it. So it doesn't make sense as you say. If these people are both going to give evidence, the person who searches and the person who witnesses, then they must both be close to the person who's been searched and see exactly what comes out of this person. So that they can both give a clear evidence in court.
Yes, on that score, I'm not And the other one is testifying, and he's going to be asked, did you see that actually being found? And he will say, no, well, I was... Secondly, on the question of privacy, I don't think the argument is flying for the reasons of the number one. There is, in any event, someone who is searching the person. So their privacy isn't really at stake. And then there is someone watching the person, not in view, in secrecy, whatever you want to call it. But I mean, if someone is watching me in terms of legislation and secrecy, I wouldn't really think that I have a lot of privacy there, whether it's in my full view or whether it is in secret or whatever the case may be. The fact is, my privacy is for good reason, I think, in this regard, in this case, but my privacy is not adhered to, or not, what do you call it, not upheld. For good reason, there is an infringement on my privacy. Whether that person is in my view or not in my view. So I really think that we must rethink this whole issue on two bases now, namely the intended idea to deal with privacy that I don't think is really being dealt with adequately then, and secondly, the testimony.
Thank you, ma'am.
Yeah, thank you. But the way I understand this, I understand it in two ways. When you look at on page 5, you look at 4, subplot 4. Subplot 4 is for the search. And then when you look at B and C, the C in subplot 4, because it's searching, there is no addition that it must not be in the view of the learner. When you get B in that subclause 4, you look at the C. And you look at the C in subclause 9. There are two different C's. Because the one in 4 is just fetching. There's no question of not in the view of the
learner. I didn't want you to go to, I wanted to go to 9A. Go to 9A. In 9A, the first person is the one who is doing the thing. A, the test is conducted by a person of the same test. I want to believe that is the first ticker. But this ticker in mind, don't go to 4, has to have a witness, which is now in C. Which is now in C. This witness is not in the same view as the one in A, which he is trying to set apart. I don't want us to take it 4.
Yeah. It's not in view of the letter, not in, not, it is not said, it is not in view of that other teacher. But it's not in view of the learner's interest, because say for example, I take you urine, you want that child to urinate in something. So that witness need not come also and see where, see the child urinating. It's only the one that is involved in the test. That one can just be there. And then, when that one is urinating, it's only the one that conducts the...
Why can't they do this with the committee? I think we're going to move in seconds.
How do you know that we should
decide one that's supposed to be? When they are urinating, it's only going to be in the front and see what happens to you. But if you allow one to do it, the crime is no longer there.
Yes.
If the second person is going to witness, to say, I did see doing it, that second person might as well be there, otherwise he's no witness. You cannot witness, he is not witness quite sure, because what he is saying is okay, that which was done by A, that first person, what that person in A is film, is exactly what I saw. I'm there to testify. If I say I'm C, I didn't see but A C, I might as well not be there.
Yeah, exactly.
Otherwise, I'm not a witness. So I didn't see. The person you say is person is A. Why don't I'm saying if you have admitted you have a third of a field and it's put with one, let us leave it for now.
There are other questions on there.
Yes.
I want to ask Buffett. It seems to me that also given the proportional requirement, it would be almost impossible to randomly search a whole school, except if there are drugs, reasonable suspicion of drugs throughout the school or something like that. Would you agree with that? So I mean, it wouldn't be possible for on a Monday morning or the time to just randomly, search the all the donors. It seems to me that if a box of data is found in one classroom, you have to search that classroom and the people involved there, not really the old school. Is that how you would understand possible interpretation? Secondly, sub 4. Let's say the number of learners going on a soccer outing somewhere, or they go for a soccer match. The principal is not necessarily going with. So it might be some of the teachers and so on and so on. But according to this, the search may only be conducted by the principal or then in a case where it's of a different gender, someone, then, only then, the principal's delegate. It really seems to me that one will have to also make provision for a delegate in the case of sub A, otherwise you might lose the whole random elements of any search. The principal will have to be present, or you have to go to the principal's place where you say whatever, and might be problematic as it is worded at the moment, in terms of activities away from the school premises itself. And I mean, the principal can also be ill or whatever the case may be. It doesn't seem to me that you make provision for that. And then the last one, in terms of the no criminal proceedings, sub 14 may be instituted by the school against the learner in respect of whom a search contemplated or conducted basis of this level found in so and so. Why is that the case? I mean, what about serious case of dealing drugs? You say now that under those circumstances, no criminal proceedings may be instituted. Is that a good idea?
On this specific one, and the international experience
has been very clear that when we deal with an infringement on the constitutional right of the nation, it must be directed to an internal outcome. And it cannot be a situation where your processes by law they just be made admissible in another process. And the limitation here is only on the school. So as I've indicated, there's a lot of other individuals who would actually go much wider than that. In fact, it was one of the difficulties in certifying this bill. The state law advisors wanted to make it a total prohibition. We've inserted by the school so that it's only focusing on the school and open up the possibility, and they agreed to it in the end that this is the process. But the senior counsel advice we've got on it, and as I said, as a result of our own research and also the research done by the state law advisors, it would be it is one of the pillars that it must be directed. It must be a clear outcome which is focused on a specific process and not opening it up for any other parallel or alternative measure.
Well, in this case, it may not be instituted in the criminal proceedings by the school, so someone else can institute it. Now, what is the position then with regard to the evidence collected and so on at that school and that are processed in the court of law? What would the position be? Would that be admissible according to your
assertion? I think it is for the court to deal with the admissibility of the evidence. Obviously, the state, the prosecutor will most probably try to make it admissible. In terms of the research we've looked at and the cases we've looked at, in the national example, it was not allowed in person. How it will be dealt with in our country is sort of issue that we will deal with.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On the same issue, when you reach 7, so the police officer receives a letter of the illegal branch. This is the receipt. This is the receipt. He knows that there's someone who has carried cocaine in a particular school. And the law enforcement office, that it does help them. Can you make a follow-up? You have to say there is a drug dealer in a particular school. He's been identified. He isn't there received as a drug because the school is serving up to the criminal school.
Sure. The police officer can still act in terms of their responsibility in terms of the contact. An individual who might be affected also by several fresh charges in terms of the Constitutional Act. But here, that option is still available. It's only the school as a legal entity that is prohibited of pursuing them. So the normal processes can still run in schools, and it can still be dealt with in terms of alternative processes. The intention of this division is to focus on the school and to deal with the safety within the school. And it's not affecting the wider process of that place.
Can we get reasons why the school is prohibited from instituting a criminal act against the learner who will be found with drugs or dangerous weapons? Because these are found within the school premises, which is actually entrusted to the municipality staff. And they must take responsibility.
The international example for this is that unfortunately we do not have any examples in South Africa. No, and that was also the finding of the paper as well. Has been that we deal with a provision of this nature, which is a
element of constitutional right, and where there can be a limitation but not the limitation of what the right to privacy in particular is a really important one, the right not to there's quite a number of rights that but the privacy one is one of the most important ones, and also the right not to be seen as or to get a innocent and not guilty. All those things come into play. The international example that we looked at, it was clear that in fact in the United States, one which was also involving a school, and where the court ruled in terms of their constitution, which had similar protections as our constitution, that it would be a negation of life if you obtained evidence from a source which was intrusive to your constitutional rights, and then use that in a situation, especially when you deal with children, and with Section 28 put an obligation on the state, you must always act in the best interest of the learner, and it's of paramount importance. So as a result of all these weighing up of all these very complex constitutional rights, the court in those cases, and it was also followed in Malaysia, and I think the other one was in Europe, so it's almost a paper. They followed the same example. They say it must be focused, there must be a clear object coming out of this whole procedure, and it should only be used for that process. And in this case, we are dealing with it on the two aspects of a code of conduct dealing with disciplinary action and dealing with it in terms of counseling. So that is the objective that we deal with. If there is other consequences flowing out of it, for instance, using a firearm, the person who left the firearm lying around for the kid to get hold of it, that person will be prosecuted. There's no doubt about it. But that is a process which is dealt with in terms of another procedure, and it is not the intention of education to regulate that at all.
I think if we want to protect the teacher, but they could end up doing nothing, saying we're not police. We are now trying to ask to do the police job, and we try for the whole process. But while you are, if they are no way, they are doing it. They are doing it to clean their school and reporting to the police. Naturally, the police cannot leave that. But if they leave, it's not the school. That's how I see it. So I protect the teacher, encourage them to look for drugs and what they do, guns and everything, not as being police, but as keeping their
Chair, actually, the comment you just made is where I want to start. That in terms of this legislation, you know, we're bringing the duties of the principal and the staff almost in line with the Criminal Procedure Act, and one needs to be careful while legislation is quite clearly necessary. One needs to be careful not to sort of try and make educators into police people, to make the principal the police station commissioner in the area. So I think that that 14 covers one where it says no criminal proceedings may be instituted by the school against the learner in respect of a search in a dangerous weapon. In other words, criminal proceedings, the duty of the principal will be to hand the evidence over to the police, and then the police will take it from there. Criminal proceedings will not be instituted by the school because, as Prof. indicates, that, you know, these are educators and not police people. The only thing is quite clearly that once the principal embark on a search and seizure,
a principal has got no no latitude, it interferes to depart from that. For example, if he gets a knife on a person in terms of this, he must hand over the knife to the police. Does the principal does not seem to have discretion to be able to stop at a particular point and say, okay, this is what my search is. I found some things on him, probably not drugs, but, you know, a pair of scissors or this or that. But it appears that the principal has no option but to hand it over to the police. And I just want to ask Advocate Rossoff about that. It just appears as if the principal does not have any option once embarked on that process. He can't decide, for example, that, okay, in my opinion, let me deal with this matter on my own. I'm not going to involve the police.
Yes, that's
correct. Chair, by mere session the letter, Educate House has trodden into the territory of the police and has endangered their lives because the learner who is armed might shoot and kill or injure the teacher. Now, if the teacher managed to identify a learner with a gun and managed to seize the gun and issue it to the police, I can't see the reason why it can't happen as it would happen in my own house, where a criminal comes and breaks into my house and steals my TV, and I open the case for this criminal. I can't see why the school cannot open the case if this is happening in the school premises.
Now take it as if it's not a criminal, it's your own son. More than if your own son has drugs, you normally, how you would react, but take it the principal as a father, mother, teacher in that school. And so I'm not using that as a way one to look at it. Don't say there was somebody coming to your home. It was your children being 82. But only thing now that is being said here, once it happened in this school environment, for the poor kids,
yeah, first of all, you think about the restriction or in principle. Contravening the law is about the position. And the only person who can take hold of that illegal stuff, and we don't want to leave off analyzing the firearms on the school premises or illegal drugs in the school premises, we want to move it away as soon as possible. But on the issue of other dangerous weapons like scissors and that type of thing, which obviously it might have been oversight, might be to give a discussion on those. But the intention of this commission was to deal with this on the dangerous weapons, the illegal firearms, the one without the license holder, and also the one where learners would not be able to. They have licenses for the illegal firearms, and also the issue of illegal drugs. The issue of the school, I think, I take what I see, I don't know if we have to actually be the state of advisor.
Yes, sir.
Just to add to what Advocate Boshoff has said, the intention mostly in the jurisdictions that deal with this issue of search and seizure in schools is to make it clear for the schools that their intention is to deal with safety in schools, not with issues of law enforcement. Now, for that to take place, and for the limitation of their constitutional rights to privacy to take place, then in the normal course of events, police would obtain a search warrant and would stick to other limitations that are required of law. But for schools to enable them to do those limitations of rights, then it has to be for that particular purpose of only dealing with safety in schools, not to prosecute, not to do law enforcement objects. So that is the main justifications that the courts have found for limiting those rights in that way, for session seizures to be carried on randomly at school. So that is the main justification that I can give the Honourable Member. Thank you.
Yes, I'm saying that say that you have example that I'm gonna take them as my children. As a principal of teacher, children within the school community are my children and I must see them as such. But if my child comes to my house with a gun, he has actually proven to me that this boy is a criminal with an illegal arm. He may kill either other people or injure me, and therefore he's a criminal. And I fail to understand why should we really treat criminals with kids' gloves. Otherwise we'll never get to the point where we shall absolve them.
Why don't we take the state or advisor that approach? He says, if we are to use the normal, a principal would not be allowed to say unless he gets a warrant from the magistrate to do that. Otherwise, the gate, that's open, it is something that is closed. So the option is to do nothing without this law. Because the only way you can do it, once you suggest a suspect as a candidate, is to go to the police, and because police go to the magistrate gives them the search warrant, they come running to the school. So in order to cut that long something, all we're saying now, let the school have some power, but if it has this power, it must not behave as if it did get a search warrant from the magistrate. So all it does now is that take the drug, take the gun, after doing that, I say, if this is kind of a compromise, it is better than nothing. And you take that now and you report it to the police. And the police surely, once they know that is a gun, they are able now to follow that. Which means the tunnels are open and things are cleared and the safety is restored at the school. I think that is the idea.
Well, I just echo to you that I think we have to leave it. If you know the gun is carried by Mr. Marwan, number eight, to get to that proper process of getting a search warrant and to deal with it in terms of that procedure and then to institute actions in that regard. But if you don't know that actually or that specific gun is carried by a specific learner and you are subjecting it to a group of learners, then it is a different and therefore the outcome will also be different because of the protection we don't in terms of the Constitution.
Are you going to Section 5
now? Yes, yes. Section 5 will also link up with Clause 11. Clause 5 is a very important one. The school acts currently provides for norms and standards regarding funding. It provides norms and standards on the minimum outcomes of curriculum and curriculum standards and assessments. But here there is a gap on what is a school? What is the makeup of a school? And the standards that are actually dealing with is, because you would find the one school which got one building and another school which is consisting of sports fields with libraries or a whole array of issues. And here the intention of the clause is to provide a clear understanding, a standard of all these various components in order
to give direction to the provinces in providing a school with all the facilities that is necessary to provide quality education. It is an enabling provision which are providing the mechanism to the minister to determine it. It's a very complex issue because there's a lot of different positions and different situations in various provinces across the country and also in schools within provinces. And therefore, it is a very taxing exercise to determine these norms and standards. But yeah, it is important that when you deal with capacity of a school to admit learners, at the moment you would find that it's such an uncertain as to how do you determine it. No wonder the court cases that we've seen up to now, it was the courts were very confused because there were no standards as to what could be the critical element to determine when is the school full. How do you determine what would be the number of learners that school can accommodate in making very important decisions which gives the right to access to schools, the quality of education and the structures that are required to deal with it. So here, this is an attempt to look at all those channels and to provide the mechanism to the minister to determine it by way of a proper process. And here, it is done by way of regulation, which will be in subordinate legislation, and that is what you would find in subclause 1. And it is very important that it is not limited to the list that's there, but the list actually highlights the important factors which are not considered in order to deal with these norms and standards. But yeah, there might be something that might be missed, some structures that could have been added. The intention was to provide broad categories, and if there's a need, the minister can also add it because of the ready has provided for it. And then, yeah, this is a very important provision because in terms of these norms and standards, you would find that clause 11, which is dealing with the identification of underperforming schools, as well as the clause 58 capital C, which is on page 8, which is dealing with the compliance of the norms and standards. It is very important that that links up with one another, because based on that, one can then determine where the problem, one can address it in terms of those measures that are identified in those sessions. And it is also, it provides that the head of the department must determine the capacity of a particular school based on the norms and standards provided by the minister in order to give some objective measures within which the decision can be taken. Here, it is also very important that when we deal with the issue of the norms and standards, it is norms and standards which is determined by the minister, where the head of department will obviously got a responsibility, as I said, on a number of issues to determine the non-functional schools and also the capacity of the schools, but it also provides an obligation on the MEC to obviously deliver in terms of the legislation. And here the legislation provides for a mechanism in terms of the Intergovernmental Relations Framework Act by way of protocol to regulate that relationship between minister and MEC in order to avoid any constitutional challenge that there might be
that there's an infringement on the rights of the provincial authorities. So here, the intention is to provide Norton standards, to deal with it in a proper way, and to coordinate the infringements through the protocols as is provided in terms of the Intergovernmental Framework Act. It also, if one turns to clause 11, and maybe it is important to deal with those because it's very important clauses, I think the first one, if I can actually from the back to the front, 58C, which deals with the compliance of the norms and standards, it is crucial that when we deal with the compliance, that the where there is a school that are not performing to standards, and where the policy which is determined by the governing body in terms of the existing provisions in the legislation, we can also now make sure that it dealt with the norms and standards and the structure which is provided for the system as a whole, so that one can get a structure or a system that consists of various structures that all working towards a common goal. So here, it is very important to look at the provisions of 58 capital C sub 2, which actually taking the functions of a governing body to make policy, and also that puts an obligation on the member of the Executive Council to ensure that they align themselves with the norms and standards which come from the minister. Then here, it is also important that there is an annual report which is provided. As I said, that if there is dispute, it will be dealt with in terms of the Intergovernmental Framework Act, and it is also important if there is non-compliance, then the head of department must identify the risk areas, all those things that are listed in clause 5, and it is also important that the head of department must then, in terms of sub 6, according to the norms and standards, determine the availability of the classrooms and the educators, determine the capacity, as I've already indicated. And that must be done not later than 30 September, so that we're from that point in time, it is the admission of learners in the school, so that brings certainty to the capacity of schools. In the other half of clause 11, that is section 55B, which is on page 7, it is dealing with the underperforming schools, and where the head of department from the report that is received from the principals in terms of their obligation to report in terms of a new section that also now has been introduced, that is section 16 capital A, will identify those schools that underperforming, and in terms of that identification will then ensure that there is specific plans implemented to rectify that shortcoming and to ensure that there is a movement to a functional school which delivers quality education to all learners, and where there is an obligation on the head of department to implement
structures and maybe that's already in legislation, but it's contained in various pieces of legislation. The Incapacity Code, for instance, which is part of the Employment of Educators Act, and also dealing with some difficulties with governing bodies, which might also be a contributing factor, then Section 22 and Section 25 of the Act comes into play. It is sub-clause 5 that I'm referring to in this particular situation. And then steps must be taken by the head of department to actually rectify that shortcoming. Here, sub-clause 5 is not introducing any new measures. It is just focusing on existing measures to ensure that that is utilized to resolve the problem that might exist. And then here, the issue of counseling of a person which is not performing properly as is contained in the Employment of Educators Act can also mean that that person will get a mentor to assist him in dealing with it. And the whole purpose of this three courses are to provide standards, create a measure to identify problems, to ensure there's proper implementation, and to identify authorities who can act in terms of these provisions.
I just want to check my understanding and probably follow up as to what the thinking behind that provision. You have indicated that the intention after to achieve standards of the key inputs that were in the existing process, which I think you've understood. I think this is also in line with the key function of the National Ministry of Normative Standards. This is an application or an amplification. Now, what I want to understand is, this being so important, what is the thinking behind making it a discretionary? I mean, if my understanding is correct, what is the name? By regulation. So this to me is a key importance, the responsibility of the National Ministry Sanitization, which may actually meet other broader policy objectives like equity, question of equity, equality, question of address, that we move forward. Now name, to me suggests that it's just discretionary. You may do that, you may not do that. But on the other hand, I'm not sure whether it is Congress or the school governing body, once those norms standards put in place, it becomes mandatory compulsory even at the end. How do we put Congress as a key function, and then other people will have to be mandatory, but with the minister to become mandatory? I just want some clarity, the thinking behind the whole of this.
It was one of those clauses which the one day it's got a may, the next day it's got a must, because any one of them could slot in very easily. But what swing it to a may in the end was that it is a very major task which will take some time to deal with it in a proper way. It is very difficult to have everything in place immediately and to have everything covered by way of norms and standards from day one. If you put a must, then it means that if the minister don't have it immediately in place, it can be challenged. And that is the difficulty that we had in the end. There's no doubt that any responsible minister will take this pleasure and use it, because that is what education is all about. That you don't want to be caught up in court cases just because practically that's not possible to deliver on it immediately. So he said that was the reason why May actually got the notch before March in the end. But it is obviously a very important revision, and the issue that's been identified there is also not, if you look at chapter 2, for instance, the provision there is not a May provision, it's a must provision. It says that the norms and standards contemplated in one must provide for that natural limiting to the following. So at least those things have been identified, it's a must. It is clearly that the minister must deal with all these issues. It is just a matter of practicality that the first one is not also be a must.
What is the other section that we're dealing with now? Are we dealing with 58C in conjunction or not?
We're dealing with 5 to 11.
So what's 11? 5 to 11. Oh, okay. 5 to 11. So they call it 11.
Okay.
Yes, can I then perhaps just ask on 58C? I know it's a bit difficult, but don't take this now as an easy action. I know it's a bit difficult because we're dealing with a member of the executive council here and not with the principal or education. But what I'm a bit concerned about, I like 58B because it's quite strong in the sense that there are certain actions that can be taken, including with regard to incapacity and whatever case may be, and it is not adhered to, you know, when the school is not performing and continues on that unfortunate path. But with regard to 58C, there is no sting in the sense that the only mechanism is basically reporting on these matters and so on, reporting again, but you know, there is no final point of accountability, some sort of a action that can be taken at some point when there is still not compliance with the norms and standards. Aren't there ways and means that you can think of to say that if there is still not compliance of the research period or the implication of it, in this, that and the other mechanism should be put in place, whether it's Parliament must take action or Parliament must look into the matter, whatever the case may be, but some or other point of final accountability or some sting, the same kind of sting, not the same kind, but a similar kind of sting than the one in 58B.
Yes, yes. My legal state advisor can also assist in this regard, because initially when we drafted the legislation, we did provide that the member of the executive council must ensure that the norms and standards are implemented, and if there is a non-compliance, then must we deal with it by way of the section 8 of the which is the monitoring and reporting to Parliament on the non-compliance of policy measures. Yeah, on the advice of the state law advisors, they changed it as it is here, and to deal with it by way of the Intergovernmental Framework Act rather than the provisions in section 8 of NEPA. So maybe here the state law advisors might be in a position to give more guidance.
Okay, can I just, in addition to that, Chair, you see, you refer to any there's a reference to any dispute, but it seems mostly to be the kind of dispute whether there is compliance or not, and not the kind of dispute as what now there is no compliance, and that seems to continuously be the position. What now? So I don't know whether sub 4 is adequate in dealing with that kind of situation. It is dealing with the question whether there's a dispute on the question of whether there's compliance or not, but not on the issue of continuous non-compliance.
Maybe just on the last question, I think it is also important that it does refer to the protocol in terms of the Intergovernmental Framework Act, which is a very important piece of legislation, which is also framed from the Constitution. And the protocol obviously identifies responsibilities, deal with the accountability issue, and also provide for the necessary resources to all get better service delivery in the end. And here I think that was also the view of the State Law Advisors, I understood it, that it is an instrument which is adopted recently to deal with the intergovernmental relationship, and that the accountability of identifying the norms and standards and the implementation in the province has been dealt with in the legislation, and that through those protocols and through the dispute mechanisms in the protocols, these possible conflict areas can also then be addressed. But the main aim of the protocol is not dispute resolution, but it is actually the gelling of all the various responsibilities, and also identifying the resources and to guide it towards the best delivery in the end. And then it is also the fact that there is a report is just is one of the mechanisms that you would also find in the protocol, that there is annually a report on the performance as it's provided in those factors.
Would it be problematic for to add to this, or would it be an option to add to this up for the question of, I think you said, reporting in terms of meet up with Parliament or the provincial legislature or whatever, or not, and comply?
Our concern was mainly with the issue of the separation between the provincial and the legislative, I mean, and the national competencies. But I think we're still open to considering the inclusion of that, and as a member has requested.
Thank you, Prof.
Just need a clarification here. This bill seeks to try minimum non standards in public schools. Now, I'm just hoping that in case of schools that might want to excel above the prescribed norms and standards following the capacity, the financial capacity that they have, they will not be limited to the prescribed one.
No, that's
the minimum is prescribed, but other schools,
when we say minimum, we don't talk prescribed limit. So nothing in this bill prevents any school getting more. All we are saying is no school that could get less. At least every school must have a library. Every school must have a land. Every school. If others have 20 libraries, they even no school can stop that, according to the
thing. Thank you.
That's my two comments on that section 5. I'm not sure whether we don't have some unfunded mandate. I'm thinking of two items of them. If you say every school must have electricity, and the budget for electricity is not with the department. I'm not saying that. And I know vast areas of my constituents. And I visited one site of Twitter for vast communities, villages, with no electricity. Where that would not, in a way, tie that MEC to provide electricity, and when we are not part of that, three, that is the question. The second one here is to do with that electricity, for example, on page 4, the kitchen facilities. I don't know that that is covered under intergovernmental, because we have just got an observation from Sport Association saying funding for creation for sports and what is this MIG. And once you put this, that money is supposed to be not with municipal intergovernmental each month, yes. So if we put this, we pass this without affecting that, to say that the money must come over, is that not some kind of, again, some unfunded money?
Yes, the turnoff was the last one. I think you correctly identified it, but as a very important vehicle in the delivery of some of these electricity, all those things. There will be some agreement between role players in order to deliver. And it doesn't mean that the money must come back, but the money should just be identified without the two water systems goal. And it's not necessarily not also currently also aiming to have the same object. So it is possible that through that vehicle all these things can be addressed. Yes, it is also very important that in the system you must provide standards, and you must, obviously, you won't get a perfect service from any place in the world. There will always be fallout, and you must manage the fallout. But you must have the standards to which you can manage the fallout. And yes, this is one of the attempts to actually provide, and it's minimum standards I'm talking about. So if there is a difficulty, the minister can obviously lower the bar in order to deal with it, and also deal with it on short-term, medium-term, long-term. There's a lot of possibilities that can be dealt with in terms of the norms. But this is the mechanism in order to focus on it and to start the standardization of it in order to get proper quality education in all our schools.
We move to section
8. Course 8 is dealing with a very important aspect, and that is also one of the issues the school a lot of difficulty in education, and that is what's the role of a principal. There's clear functions of governing bodies. There is the role of the department, the head of the department. But the principal, there is a provision which is currently in section 16 to say that the principal is performing the function under the control and authority of the head of the department. And then in section 23 and 24, it says that the principal is ex officio a member of a governing body. And here, when you look at court cases, you would find that the principal is not very clear as to what is the role of the principal. Is he a member of the governing body who must actually determine a very definite and leading role within that governing structure? Or is he or she the eyes and ears of the head of the department in performing the function and to deal with this partnership as the crucial link in this relationship? With this, it is to try and bring some certainty as to the role. And this proposal is to say the principal represents the head of the party in the school. He or she is acting in his official capacity in the governing body and are actually dealing with issues there as the representative of the department in order to avoid this day as scenario. The head of the department cannot be in all the governing bodies, and the principal can deal with the educational issues. Those delivery in the classroom matters, which is also very important for governing bodies. So, Chair, it is also important that the principal who is taking the responsibility of the school on behalf of the head of the department must also report on these key issues, the academic performance of the school, and also the effective utilization of resources of those schools in order to ensure that proper delivery and quality education takes place in that school. And yet this is also a very important instrument in identifying those underperforming schools. It's not the only one, because it's also linked up to our school evaluation. But this is a very important provision, which will also provide at least a basis on which the head of the department can take action. But it is also important that when the principal in the public school is then identified as an underperforming school, there's an obligation to put a plan in place to deal with the shortcomings and to provide a plan which is approved by the head of the department to address it on the short and medium term. And then it also makes it clear that the principal is undertaking the professional management of a public school and in carrying out these duties, there's a list. It's not all inclusive because there is an employment relationship where through circulars and direct instruction, added functions and responsibility can come from the employer. But at least it gives the basic functions that the principal must perform in that the relationship. And then it also provides clarity on the participation in the governing body. It also deals with the assistance to the governing body on disciplinary matters where the function is actually with the governing body. Money matters as well. It is a function which is with the governing body. But the principal is part of the school and is a very crucial link in it. And there must be assistance but not the actual responsibility is not worth it. And then it's also important that it is to provide, obviously, information to the governing body about policy and legislation, and also to provide accurate data to the head of the department when required to do so. It also provides that the principal must deal with the responsibility and participate in these structures. And it cannot be, his or her participation cannot be in conflict with the instructions and the mandates coming from the employer. Because that is, he is representing that employer. And then it must be in line with, obviously, legislation and policies. And then lastly, as the representative of the employer, as the representative of the department, the principal if there is a case against the minister, the head of the department or MEC, the principal, who is the one who must actually perform the function on behalf of that entity, should be the prime witness of the minister or the head of the department or the MEC. That in reality is not the case. We've got a number of cases where an application is brought and the prime witness for the school is the principal. And that actually takes away the defense which the school or the head of the department should have had by using the principal as his or her prime witness. There might be situations where the principal might not be used by the minister or the executive council or the head of the member of the executive council or the head of the department, but can still be a crucial witness in the court case. And then it is for the court to take a decision to say, well, I want to hear what's going on, why the principal is not called as a witness. So it is not to muddle the principal at all. That's not the intention of it. But the intention is to make sure that principal, you're an employee of the state, you are performing your function as an employee within a clear framework where you represent the head of the department and the minister and the MEC, and when you do that, you have a responsibility not to act in conflict, and because you're not acting or you cannot act in conflict with your responsibility, you should be the prime witness if there is a dispute, and you cannot be distracted by the fact that you're also a member of the governing body, and you now become a prime witness for the opposition in that particular case. And here it is the intention to clarify there is, other than the report, there's nothing new that came out of this session which has not been underlying to what is in the legislation. But in practice, it was not always understood in that way, and there was a lot of confusion.
Any comment or question?
The prevention of the principal to give evidence to against the minister or any head of the department here creates a problem as far as I'm concerned, because the headmaster works hand in glove with the governing body, and if anything has happened as a person who even participates and advises the members of the governing body, I think if the governing body has a case with the minister, the principal is much more inclined to be having some information that he can actually assist the court with. Now, I really don't see the reason why should this information from the principal be obscured from the court. Thank you.
I'll try to push you. My time is almost ready by.
Yes.
And I want to have more points of clarity. That's specific enough. Because
I think which matters to us, B and C, sub C 4. It says today that if the head of the department approves that they will perform this improvement plan, then the principal must write 30 June the report to the head. But what now if the head of the department doesn't approve? Shouldn't you make provision for that as well, to say that then the head of the department must set a new date after the plan has been approved, something like that. That is 30 June now, but no indication as to what if it is sent back and so on by the head of the department. No indication as to by when then should the report be given to the head of the department.
And then, secondly, also I have a question on what about, also about sub 4. I mean, that is creating a situation now where you are actually expecting that, and have you thought through what the effect of that could be, you know? Creating a situation where the principle could then be at odds with, or will always be at odds with any court action instituted, for instance, instituted by the specific school. So there would be a conflict now between the principal and the school on the court action. While in many cases, principal might play a role in deciding, you know, to take a specific matter to court. Is that a healthy situation from that perspective? Maybe from the department's perspective, you know, a good situation, because you will now have the principal as your prime witness and so on. But even from that, from the school environment perspective, it's a good thing. And is it constitutional to prohibit someone to give evidence in the state of the rule of law of life?
I'm interested sort of generally, but also specifically to the functions and responsibilities of the principal in a public school. The 37 comments that were received in terms of public comments, are those comments available to us, and what were the comments specific to this section that were particularly contentious or that you had to deal with in putting this together, especially around this area of the principal having to be not be a witness?
Why don't we hold on that one? Now we have public hearing. The department has had its own public hearing of comments and what they do, and they ended up with this one. We are going to have our own public hearing. If they are ready to get satisfaction, they are going to bring to us. I don't want us to get there now.
In terms of the duties of Prince Abuchin to management all the collections to support the producer, we need more clarity on that, because within a school there are other stakeholders, and I'm speaking of what has been stored in the school, not as you know. How would you deal with those?
Yeah, I think the first thing one must put up front is not to muscle the principal. The principal will still be available as a witness. And it is not uncommon for a person who is an employee as a manager to be expected to have a loyalty towards the employer. Because that's the person who's actually performing the function on behalf and represents that employer in the day-to-day function. You would find it in the private sector, if a senior manager or a manager goes against the company, that person would be, the services will be terminated. We know that communication is a very complex arrangement, and rightly so, it is challenging for a principal to be in that vulnerable position. So here, the issue here is to make sure that when you deal with an inspection issue, where the case is against the department and the minister, not in all the cases, if it's against a a company who delivers the prototype machine, the principal can act as a witness, no problem. It is only where it is against the member of the executive council, the minister, or the head of department, then it is expected for the principal to be loyal towards the employer and to deal with it from the responsibility of the position. He's a member of the governing body, ex officio. Ex officio. Purely because of his position. And his position is that of a public servant. And that is what we're dealing with here. And we are of the opinion that it is not unconstitutional to deal with it. It is not preventing any evidence from court. In an application, you don't have to actually to choose the respondent, to choose the deponent. If the governing body already used the principal as the first deponent, then you can't even consult with the one who's representing you in your case. It's a very difficult position to manage. And that is what we try to address here. So it is not to prevent the rule of law. It is not to create obstructions to the process. But it is just to clarify the role, because there was a misunderstanding. Because principals didn't read or didn't interpret it, what was meant by ex officio. In many cases, the principals are actually acting as governing bodies, and that is what's causing the dispute. With this provision, where the role is much more clear, and there is now an obligation not to act in conflict with the instructions and the policies, we expect that also the number of indications that might come where the principal takes a leading role will be far lesser. So, the issue around the other employees and other structures, so the other employees, obviously one must remember there is a personal administrative measure where all the posts and the post requirements and the conditions of service are all spelled out, and the legislation does not provide a specific reference to the other employees or educators. But for the principal as the manager, it provides a delegated authority in terms of Section 16 by way of a statutory provision, because it's way back in, until many of the members were also party to that process in 1996, the issue that the Parliament had to face at that stage was, would it be possible to delegate to 29,000 schools? If you don't give a statutory delegation to the principal, there might be a lot of schools who could not function because there was no delegation to the principal to act on the site as the representative of the principal. And that is why in the original piece of legislation, the principal got a very prominent role to play. And as I said, to represent the employer or the head of the department is something new, it's already there. But with this provision, it is just to give substance to those one or two liners that we added in the legislation. And through the years, we've picked up, of course, a lot of confusion because it's two structures, it's two authorities, it's conflicting in some changes, and the principal is nowhere to side. With this, it is clear that the principal got a definite role to play, and that is to be the representative of the state and to ensure that the relationship is the eyes and or she's the eyes and ears of the head of department, that the governing body got a different role to play. And if there is anything of an educational nature, the governing body do have educators also as their members, which is not ex officio. They've got a specific position on the governing body structure, and they can also advise and deal with issues in that regard.
Thank you very much.
Saying that whatever Mr. Boshoff says about presenting the headmaster to give evidence in court, the fact of the matter is, by mere presenting him to give evidence in court, you are infringing upon his right to freedom of speech, and that is unconstitutional. You cannot say you are not in conflict with the Constitution.
Maybe the better way of understanding, anything against the minister is against the principal. If we have, I think, that understanding. The principal in a school, the principal in an FDP, he is not part of the FDP. If the FDP has any problem, he is there and eyes and ears. If there is a conflict, that conflict is not going against anything. It's not against the head. It's against the policy. That has been by him. Therefore, anything against the MEC, it is against the principal. Once we look at it from that angle, therefore, there is no way. Remember, it's a kid guy in a school. It's not the responsibility of that school. It's the responsibility of the province to show that the link goes to the province. If you understand it that way, if you understand it.
There are other instances where the principal may not be at fault. The principal and the school governing body, who work together on a daily basis, might be having something in common which is right. And the MEC or the minister is also a human being, he might be wrong somewhere, and he might not want to be exposed. And therefore, the principal must be mum. I'm trying to follow the resume. Say the principal is the reality. The principal is a member representative of the union in the school. And the member of the school is doing a case of the MEC. Okay? And according to this legislation, the maximum.
But that's a union, not a city. Remember, I'm talking about FDP. I'm saying there's a school governing body in a school. Yes. I'm saying in a school governing body, in that school governing body, when he's managing and running, he is there as an ex officio. He is not a member. He is there to listen, understand, take these issues to the MEC, because all those problems are confronting either problems with the policy. So once that happens, he cannot just cut off and say, I'm part of this entity.
I think there's a conditional clause here that was received. It was an 8 years for the principal arguing on the laptop. It is subclause 4 then. Unless a court of law directs otherwise. So they face then to protect the constitutional
rights.
Then just one aspect, the technical thing that I mentioned on the C4 of the 30 June. Remember that
one? I think that is an issue that the committee can look into. It is obviously an issue which is not in the
Can we move on?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think from the other issues are less contentious, I hope. Chair, clause 9 is dealing with the issues of amendment to section 20, which is for the functions of the governing body, and it provides that an add-on to what is already in section 20. It provides in E capital A that where there is a decision by the head of department in terms of section 16, and that is the incapacity of an educator or a principal, then the governing body must support. It is just to avoid a playoff between the employer and the governing structure in order, because when an individual are put in that corner, it uses the one against the other in order to try and get out of the spot instead of focus on the real problem. So here, that is the intention there. In B, in paragraph B, which is an amendment to 20G, it is just add on to what's already there, which is the administration and control of school property and buildings and grounds occupied by the school, including hostels. That also, that the exercise of this power must not in any manner interfere with or otherwise hamper the implementation of a decision made by the head of the NEC or the head of the department in terms of any law or policy. It's once again linked to the norms and standards and the functions to coordinate and ensure that we deal with a system where all the authorities must act in harmony with one another as far as possible. Then here also in the next one is the J capital A, which also provides a new function to say that when the governing body make a recommendation as contemplated in J, deal with the appointment of educators, they must do it within the time frame as is contemplated in section 6.3L of the Employment of Educators Act, and that means that within a period of 2 months the governing body must make a recommendation. If they fail to do so, then the head of the department will go ahead and appoint. Here, that is just to shorten the time frame for appointment, which is currently a problem in schools.
Yeah,
the next one is a technical amendment, which is a new act which deals with the auditing profession, and we've still got the reference of the old act to correct that. Chair, we've dealt with clause 11 already. Chair, clause 12 is an important one because of the definition that's been added to what is a school activity. There's been different concepts in the Schools Act, because section 60 can be talked about an educational activity, and it, in order to avoid a different context and to make it consistent with one another, there's an amendment to also bring it to school activities so that it reads with one another. Section 60, as you can remember, it is the liability on the state to take up the responsibility if there is a claim against the school for any contractual judicial case, or in any contractual judicial claim against the school. Whether, and then here it is also an aspect that many schools do have insurance, they pay for the insurance, and by the time they want to recover it from the insurance, they know section 60 makes it the obligation to go and get it from the department, so they pay the money for full year and don't get any value out of it. Yeah, this is just in line with the recent judgment that came in from the Free State, where the court ruled also that it is possible to claim from the insurance company and to get that benefit. And we just clarified in law that Section 60 is just to provide assistance to schools where there is no insurance. If there's insurance, then they pay for it and they must get the benefit of that insurance policy. Yeah, clause 13 is dealing with the National Student Financial Aid Scheme Act. Here it is just an amendment as a result of the Further Education and Training Colleges Act, where the name and the terminology used there has also been introduced into this piece of legislation in order to extend it not only to higher education students, but also to further education and training institutions. So here it is just an extension of that, and you would find clause 13, clause 14, 15, 16, 17, all dealing with, and 18, dealing with the same issues. Then here, clause 19 is just a technical amendment to the South African Council of Educators Act as a result of the Further Education and Training Act, where there's no educators left in colleges. It is just to correct that in that piece of legislation. Here, the same with clause 20. There is no educators, it's now lecturers and management staff, and obviously it is introducing that as a defined category of employees in a institution. So here it is just aligning it with the legislation adopted last year. Here it is also the situation with clause 21, where the reference to the membership also now includes educators and lecturers. Here the rest is, as I said, just technical amendments in relation to that. Clause 22 is dealing with Basic Education and Training Act. Once again, it is the word auditor has been deleted from it in the definition, and it is also then linked up with the further issues around the establishment of the centers, where it is linked to Further Education and Training Act of 1998, and that reference to that has now also just been deleted out of the Basic Education and Training Act. So it's just cleaning up that piece of legislation. 24 is linked to 22, and that is just to deal with the name change of the Auditing Professions Act and not the Accountants and Auditors Act anymore. And then here, 25 is dealing with the GENFEQA, or the General Further Education and Training Quality Assurance Act, and that is once again dealing with the consequences of the new Further Education and Training Colleges Act, which came into effect last year. All the others, the amendments in 26 also exactly the same, and 27 is just the short
time. Any questions
on those?
That's now a timetable for this week. First of all, today we are having our meeting. our term has been cutting. The week of the 17th, 18th, 19th, we have simple assembly, which is happening in Eastern Cape. And the week following that should be consequently week, which means we have to deal with this deal between now and the 14th. We have these aspects are going out over the weekend for the stakeholders to make their submission. And the deadline for their submission is the 6th of next month. So they'll be given plus minus 12 days thereabouts. And then the proposal now is that the week starting on Monday, the 10th, up to the 14th, we need to within that week do deal with this deal and finish. So the proposal is we use Monday. Remember, Mondays are our constituency days. The proposal says that Monday, then, we must use it for our public hearing. And that public hearing should not stop at 15, 17 hours. It must go up to and including 21 hours, so that we accommodate all stakeholders within that Monday. That is Monday, then. That is Monday, the 21st. Again, on Tuesday, the 11th, having heard the presentation, we as different parties mull over that so that we get a sense as to which way, what we think we should do. On Wednesday, the 11th, we meet for what we refer to now as informal consultation. Wednesday the 12th. So it is Wednesday the 12th. We come together for informal consultation. It's where then that we have to look at the presentations, we have made our decisions as what are our stances. And that is where we are going to be doing that arm twisting. Saying, another point now, these principles are not part of our system. We'll be doing that arm twisting on that Wednesday the 12th. We are then leave Thursday the 11th for consultation with our people.
Yeah. All right.
Okay, so you see, this is the problem.
Yes, this is the problem.
So I think we've got to work out a system, but I'm just not happy with the way that this is good,
yeah.
But then that doesn't look good.
Okay. So what must I do? Because if you didn't put this thing then those are the best people who complain about that. Is anybody working at this computer?